This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello everyone, this is Lana. I'm super thrilled to introduce you to my next guest, Peter Henriksen, the author of Cracking the Code. If you want to crush and tear down the matrix a whole lot more, keep listening. You're about to hear about a complex combo of craft, bureaucratic incoherence, and corruption that has led the masses to inadvertently allow and participate in the legal transformation of their untaxable earnings into taxable income. You are being tricked into signing your money away. The U.S. tax system is based on individual self-assessment and voluntary compliance. The government will, of course, accept your money unless you inform it every year that you are entitled to non-payment or to a refund of what you have paid. Tens of thousands of readers of Cracking the Code have taken control of their own resources in accordance with the law. How can this be? Well, keep listening. Welcome, Peter. I've really been looking forward to this interview, so thank you for being here today.
That's my great pleasure.
First off, tell us a bit about your background and how you first began digging into the mythical beast that is the U.S. tax code.
Well, I don't have a background specifically in law, although at this point in my life I'm pretty thoroughly self-educated. But the origin of my interest arose in 1976, which was the bicentennial of the American Revolution, and in that year, in keeping with the spirit of the occasion, I reread the Constitution, something I hadn't done in a number of years at that point, or viewed as something necessary to be real familiar with. I was a young man at the time, probably not a whole lot more interested in that sort of subject than anyone else of my age, but I did read it then, and I was struck by an anomaly. The Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution has a specification, tax-related specification, and it says that capitations and other direct taxes shall be apportioned, and that's actually repeated in another spot in the Constitution. It's the only thing that's actually in there twice. And I looked up capitations, discovered what the constitutional meaning of capitations was, which is, by the way, not what most people would imagine. People tend to think of that as a head tax and translate that into a poll tax, and neither of those things is actually true. Constitutionally, a capitation is a tax on undistinguished revenue. It's on just general revenue. And looking at that definition and looking at the income tax as it appears to be being administered, it seemed to me that the income tax is a capitation. It qualifies under that definition. And, of course, it's not apportioned. So I was struck by that, and it bothered me, and I began looking further into the subject of the income tax because it really is a really big subject. I mean, not a big subject in the sense of a massive study, although it is that too, but it's a big subject in terms of its importance. If you look at the significance of the income tax in American life, it absorbs something on the order of maybe 35% to 45% of all the earnings of most every working American all their lives, all their adult lives. It's a huge factor. It's far and away the biggest single financial factor in anybody's life, in any American's life, at least any American until the last 10 years. We'll get to that in a minute. So it's the 800-pound gorilla in the living room. It's a really big subject in that sense, in the sense of its importance. It's also a big subject in the sense of being a grueling study. And back in 1976 and in the years from there up through the turn of the century, it was an impossible subject because the tax code alone is about 3.5 million words long. And that's intended to be a helpful condensation of the actual statutory language that is reflected in the code, which is much larger, perhaps twice as big, maybe 7 million words. And on top of that, there is a regulatory body of associated material that's bigger still. So if you add the volume necessary to pour through to really get an accurate understanding of this subject of the law, you're talking perhaps 15 million words, maybe 20 million words of text. And not easy text, but the typical confused legalese jumble of apparent gibberish, requiring a lot of study and teasing out of meaning and so forth. And during that period from 1976 to the turn of the century, it was virtually impossible to make any sense of it. You think about that volume of material. You're talking about, not perhaps an entire library's worth of material, but a big chunk of a library. Mm-hmm. And to study it and read through it, by the time anyone got any meaningful fraction, or not even a meaningful fraction, just a slight fraction of the way through that volume, it would be months that had gone by, and it would be impossible to remember what you'd started seeing when you began the study. So it's just impossible to really make proper sense of. And no wonder, then, that everyone has always just kind of taken their accountant's word for the obligations imposed by the code or the law, or their tax attorneys or, the IRS's. Most people just do what their mother or father told them to do in terms of tax activities. So, again, up till the turn of the century, 2001 actually in my case, it was impossible to make sense of this beast. However, at that time, I was impelled to begin a new study of the subject, having kind of prior to that decided that the best I could do was presume that the tax was simply being imposed in defiance of the constitutional rules, in defiance of that apportionment rule that I referred to earlier, which is, the distribution of an established tax total amongst the state governments, and it's the apportioned tax is remitted by the state governments, not remitted by citizens. The founders set things up so that the federal government never has a direct access to citizens' resources. Now, there is no such thing as a tax structure under our federal structure or our federal system in which the federal government can actually reach directly into a citizen's pocket. So, in 2001, I was compelled to renew my study, or to become kind of a relaxed take on the subject. I was compelled to renew my study because at that time, contrary to past practices, an IRS official decided that the return that my wife and I had filed for the year 2000, which had on it a disclaimer that was the same as what we had been putting on our returns for all the time we had been filing them, which says that we stand by the numbers on the form in terms of representative of our earnings, but we refuse to declare those earnings to qualify as income, mm-hmm. as that term is meant in the context of the form. Never had a problem with that in the past. No one had ever raised an eyebrow or taken any issue with it, but this time somebody did. And they said that they'd be happy to process our form as long as we would remove that disclaimer.
Of course.
And they said, we have to endorse, my wife and I have to endorse the characterization of our earnings as income for the service to be able to process the return. And I had a light go off when this got said. Suddenly, maybe as a consequence of the things I'd learned previously, what little I'd been able to glean from looking at the hard copy material and other people's studies of the subject, the light bulb went off and I said to myself, why does it matter whether we say that this stuff qualifies as income or not? If it does qualify, it wouldn't matter whether we said so or not. We could disagree all day long. We could agree all day long. It wouldn't make any difference. If it's an objective truth, it's objectively the case, then it doesn't matter what we say. And I said that to them, and they said, well, we've got to have you guys say that it's income. And so, the conclusion was fairly obvious. There was something, it was not objectively income, or at least couldn't be taken to be objectively income, and there was something really critical in the application of the tax in the fashion that it is administered to our saying that our income qualified. And that renewed my study. My interest, because I wasn't going to back down on this subject, and the IRS indicated they weren't going to either. And so I began studying again, and this time I had the benefit of the fact that the tax law had been digitized, and I could actually tear into it with a computer. Suddenly, that 7 million words or more was searchable, in seconds. I could cross-reference terms. One of the key things about the tax, the way the law is set up, it uses many terms of art, which are homonyms for common words, but that have special statutorily provided meanings. And in the study of the law, it's very critical to understand these things. And when looking at the hard copy, this is one of the things that was most impossible about trying to do this prior to digitalization. One would encounter a term, not necessarily know it's a term, first of all, because the definition would not appear at the same place as the term first appeared. And maybe as many as 400,000 words later, you would come across the meaning that that term has in the place that you first found it 400,000 words earlier. And it's critical to understand that meaning. In the intervening time until you got to the definition, you would have been presuming and letting, you know, percolate into your head and you know, become sort of a fixed picture that the term has its normal meaning, that it doesn't have a statutory definition. Because, again, it will not have been presented as special at that point. And when you finally learn it, it just becomes... it's impossible to integrate and to sort out properly. But having the digital version, suddenly these things can be addressed and discovered immediately. And once I discovered that these special terms were in use, which was, you know, part of the light bulb moment when they said, we have to use this term, we have to apply this term to our earnings in order to move forward, that told me that, you know, income is not the all that comes in that we think of in common usage, and it isn't a casual word or term in the law. It's actually a really critical one, and that suggests a special meaning. So my study then began focusing on these terms of art, and once those were sorted out and known, reading through the law, suddenly it all made sense. Every bit of it made sense. And it all was coherent and harmonious and fully constitutional as well. So I went from being perhaps the one of the world's most vehement opponents of the income tax and critics of it as an unconstitutional, you know, rogue government affair, mm-hmm. to being perhaps its most articulate advocate and the one best able to explain how and why it is indeed a fully constitutional tax, not only fully constitutional, but a benign and actually beneficial tax. It's a tax I would not be without. At this point, as much as I had disliked it, denounced it, and condemned it in the past, over the last 10 years, I am its biggest fan. So that's how it happened.
Interesting. Now, if we back up a little bit, what do you know about the origins of the income tax?
Well, it's quite different than the mythology that people are led to imagine. The income tax did not begin in 1913. Its origin has nothing whatsoever to do with the 16th Amendment. It literally began in 1861, but was replaced in its entirety the following year. So 1862 is the actual birth date of the income tax we know and loathe today. It was a tax born during the war between the states. Lincoln wanted a repeating revenue source, and so he devised this structure, which really is based on a similar tax, King's Revenue version number 9 from the English system, in which the king taxes privileged beneficiaries with an excise tax, which is, you know, privilege tax, excise tax, those are actually synonymous terms in tax law. And that's exactly what the income tax is. It's an excise. It's a piece of the action on gains made from the use of federal stuff. It's a privilege tax. It's a tax on federal income. And, you know, the name actually says the whole story. The name describes exactly the nature of the income tax. It is a tax on federal income. And so, because it is a tax on federal income and not income in the common sense of the word, it has to be understood, and I'm going to, you know, hope that it will be understood going forward in this conversation, that when I use the expression income, I'm using it with quote marks around it, and I'm referring exclusively to the subclass of all that comes in that represents the part of what comes in or what might come in any given budget or household of the part from the use of the beneficial use of federal stuff. And in most people's budgets and households, that's nothing. Most people don't have anything that qualifies as income within the context of the tax law, because most people don't use federal privileges to make gains of any kind. Those privileges are fairly specific. The law is pretty explicit about what qualifies. And really, it is within the range of what qualifies. Pretty much all of it is subject to the tax, although not literally all of it is actually taxed. So, but while perhaps 30, maybe 40 million Americans do have a taxable amount of this quote-unquote income, 270 million or so don't. And so knowing this information is really, really very important to anybody and everybody.
So the meaning of income, according to the IRS, is it the same meaning in the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's been complete consistency on the subject. You know, court opinions have to be read with a certain amount of care because the courts only address the subjects that are actually brought up by the litigators. And so there are some case law that may seem a little bit strange at first glance until it's the actual underlying cases are looked into and it's discovered what actually is being argued about and what isn't being argued about. But they're 100% consistent.
But yet complying with the law is much different than complying with the IRS, right?
Well, you know, the fact is the IRS doesn't cross the line, or rarely anyway, crosses the line into violating or being in compromise with the actual law. They nurture a reputation of being this, junkyard dog agency, and they like, I think, for people to imagine them to skirt the law, to operate kind of outside the law, to not be bound by law anyway. But that really isn't true. The structure of the law is set up so that, just as was revealed in that light bulb moment that I had, people are brought to impose the tax on themselves when it doesn't actually apply or wouldn't normally apply to their earnings. The IRS doesn't do that to anybody. They readily and happily exploit ignorance on any of these subjects, and they will operate like a junkyard dog when they are given a plausible reason to do so, a plausible pretext for doing so. So if somebody, for instance, the way the tax operates is this, and this is also the way that it misoperates, so to speak. Everybody in this country has been encouraged, been trained, really, conditioned, to imagine that there is a requirement that every payment that gets made, that they make to anybody else, has to be reported to the government. And just on its face, if you think about that, you know, for an instant, you know, it ought to raise an eyebrow and cause one to think, you know, how could that possibly be? But the conditioning is that this is what you do, and it's sort of a path of least resistance affair. You know, your accountant will tell you that this is true. Your tax attorney will tell you that this is true. Certainly, any tax agency person will tell you that this is true. What they won't tell you, the way they'll do it is they'll say you have to report any income that you pay out to anybody. If you pay anybody self-employment income, you have to report it. If you pay anybody wages, you have to report it. If you pay anybody, in connection with your trade or business, you have to report it. What they don't tell you is that all of those things I just mentioned, wages, self-employment income, trade or business, for instance, are all specially defined, custom-defined terms in the law. They don't mean what you think they mean. And they won't tell you that these are, by the way, these are all specially defined terms. Go look them up before you do what I just told you. No one's going to say that. They'll just tell you, you report all the wages paid, you report all the trade or business payments made, et cetera, et cetera. And people do that. And once they have done that, what they actually are doing when they do that, they do it in the form of information returns, which are typically W-2s, 1099s, and K-1s. Those are the kind most people see. Those forms declare two different things. They declare an amount paid, and they declare a legal status of that amount. There's an assertion made by the creator of the form that the payment that's reported on it was made in connection with federal privilege. Those forms are only to be used for that kind of payment, for a federal privilege payment. And so when they get made, a copy of it gets sent to the taxing authorities, and a copy of it gets sent to the person about whom the form is made. And it is on the basis of that allegation, that implicit allegation. If you look at the language that dictates what is to be reported on a W-2, for instance, it does not say, report how much you paid a worker. What it does say is, report how much was paid to a worker that qualifies as wages in sections 3121A and section 3401A of subtitle C of Title 26. That's what you're reporting when you write down a number on the W-2. Now, the person who's writing it down, they have no idea that that's what it says because they've never looked. And if they did look, and even if they read that part, they would assume that the definitions that they would find if they went to the trouble of looking them up would be just, what you paid the worker. But that's not what they are. So, but because those specifications exist, when a W-2 shows up at the IRS, it is taken as an allegation, a formal allegation, that worker, Joe Smith, whatever his name is, was paid in connection with a federally privileged activity. And they will then wait for Joe Smith to respond to that allegation. Joe, he got a copy of that W-2 also, and it was not sent to him in order to help him write the correct numbers down on his tax forms. It was sent to him as notice, formal notice, putting him on notice that an allegation was made, that he did something upon which a liability to the federal government will arise. Now, Joe then has his option. He can either stand silent, and after a period of time, that allegation will be taken as true because Joe had his chance to rebut it, and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's taken that he agreed with it. Or he will agree with it, maybe because it's true, maybe because he doesn't know any better either. Or maybe he'll rebut it and correct it and say, no, actually, I did get paid the amount, but it was not in connection with the federal privilege, so, there actually were no wages paid at all, meaning wages as defined in those sections of law.
And then people are participating, like you were saying, in the legal transformation of their untaxable earnings into taxable income.
Exactly, and this is why I say the IRS does not cross the line into doing something illegal in this case. They're not going to tell somebody, you have to write your earnings down and call them wages or anything like that. They simply will allow people to make this mistake on their own, to not know what they're doing, make this mistake, and once they've received a 1040 that has that W-2 amount written down on it in the income section, the legal contest is over at that point. Okay, everybody's in agreement. Joe Smith got paid wages, quote-unquote. They have the quotes around him, too. Again, it's a special customized term. He was paid wages, therefore he owes us a chunk of it. He owes us some money. And they'll calculate the assessment if Joe didn't already do it correctly, and they'll send a bill or keep the whatever was withheld or what have you. That's how it works. Now, the real question is, were Joe Smith's earnings wages or income under any other subcategory? Because income, the quote unquote income, is itself subcategorized in a variety of different ways. Wages being one of them, self-employment income being another. And there are several others. Did his earnings actually qualify for that? Well, if they didn't, then Joe just made them do so, as far as the law is concerned. He created the appearance that he did indeed get paid for engaging in federal privilege and the tax properly applied to him. Joe had other options, though. Had Joe known what he was doing and known what was being said about him, he could have rebutted those allegations if they were not true, and sent in a 1040 with correct information. And had he done so, he would have received a complete refund back of anything that had been withheld, including Social Security and Medicare, just as tens of thousands of readers of my books do every year, and have been doing so for 10 years now, without interruption from the state or from the federal and 33 state governments. And he would have been a much better off individual, had retained control of his own resources, Many people would view that as a plus simply because they're being kept out of the hands of the federal government, which a lot of people are unhappy about how those resources are used. In any event, what happened to them would have been Joe's call to make, as opposed to them being taken from him improperly. In many cases, spent against his interests.
Now, there's another important aspect of this. I'm going to read a quote from your book from Jerome Kurtz, the IRS commissioner, says, "The IRS's primary task is to collect taxes under a voluntary compliance system." They keep using this voluntary compliance system. So talk about that.
It's got to be borne in mind that even people with fancy titles like Jerome Kurtz's at that time, he was a political appointee, far and away not an expert at the subject of the tax law or anything else probably. I don't know what he did to get his position, but it's the same sort of thing that you do to become an ambassador to Belgium, make the right political connections and so forth. But there is a thing about the voluntary compliance concept. And we see it in a lot of places, even some courts that do know what they're talking about. And that is not all courts, by the way. Tax law is not understood any more in courtrooms than it is anywhere else. But there is a voluntary component, and that is this. Engaging in the privileged activities upon which the tax actually falls is completely voluntary. No one is obliged to do it. That's one of the reasons why this tax survives what otherwise would be a constitutional problem, since capitations and other direct taxes being taxes that are not voluntary, taxes that can't be avoided, have to be apportioned. Well, this one isn't, and how is that the case? It's because no one is obliged to engage in the privileges upon which the tax falls. Now, if someone does engage in those privileges, that tax becomes as mandatory as a heart attack. There's no voluntary involved at that point. But bringing the liability into play in the first place by engaging in the privileged activity, 100% voluntary. And that's what's meant by those otherwise kind of incongruous sounding expressions.
Got it. Now, if someone finds themselves in court, as you did, can the "you can't constitutionally tax me" argument hold any power?
Well, it's a constitutional tax, so no, it can't. And in fact, one of the gimmicks that the tax division of the DOJ loves to run is to try and characterize arguments against in any particular situation in a courtroom as being some kind of constitutional argument. But there isn't a constitutional argument with the tax. You can certainly make the constitutional point that the apportionment requirement applies to capitations and other direct taxes. Therefore, with the income tax not being apportioned, it is clear that the income tax is not a capitation or other direct tax. Therefore, we look at what a capitation falls on, and it's actually very, very elaborately laid out, a series of things that qualifies capitation. And therefore, we can say that whatever the income tax is, it can't be any of these things. And that argument can fly, and that is more or less a constitutional argument. But normally, because the tax is constitutional, there would be no reason to make a constitutional argument.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that would arise in a court case is a matter of what allegations have been made about any given earnings being or not being actually taxable, taxable distinguished character. And how that evidence has been treated. Has it been rebutted? Has it been agreed to? Has it been agreed to by silence? Those are the issues. And it's only in the last 10 years that people have known what's going on here, known this subtext issues, and therefore been equipped to address these problems. There's been very little litigation so far involving people educated about this subject, and so we don't have a real substantial body of law. What we have seen in the few cases that have gone on are really almost ludicrously absurd contortions on the part of the government to try and evade dealing squarely with people who do know what they're doing in these situations. And so we've really ridiculous assertions. People there's the argument's been brought up in court that a zero on a return is an impossibility. It can't be credited as valid. That's ridiculous on its face. If you look at any tax table that's associated with any tax return form for any year that of your life, you will find the very first entry is zero. So to suggest that somehow zero is not a viable or legitimate figure to appear on a tax return is on its face absurd.
Yeah.
And yet the DOJ has made these arguments because it has no other arguments to make. It's in a kind of a state of desperation. So
now, is an educated filer just as successful today as we were back in, let's say, 2005, or is the IRS becoming more effective in discouraging or even stopping educated filers from doing the same?
It's not effective in stopping anyone. As far as discouraging is concerned, it's difficult for me to say. Educated filers continue to get all their money back. At least I don't think that you had been a regular Lost Horizons visitor distant into the past. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but if you have been recently, you'll have seen that I continue to post victories. I call them victories. They're victories for the rule of law, in my view, when a citizen who has become educated enforces the law by standing up and introducing their accurate testimony and standing by it. They win a victory when they get that refund check or that zero transcript or that notice of deficiency closing notice or the lien release or the levy release or what have you. That's a victory for the law. And they continue to happen every day. So what the volume is, that's impossible for me to say. So I can't say whether or not it's more or less than at any other time. Judging from the ongoing contortions by the IRS, which just recently, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, a massive hoax on the part of the IRS where they're actually misrepresenting a formal statute-based notice structure on their website. They're actually lying outright about the inclusion of a provision in that formal notice, saying that there is one when there actually is not. And the one that they're saying is there is a made-up characterization of a educated filing as being frivolous. On their website, they are saying that in the formal notice that the secretary is mandated to issue, such filings are declared as a frivolous thing, and they actually are not in that formal notice because, of course, they're not frivolous. But the IRS is compelled to pretend that they are and to perpetrate this hoax because they're trying to discourage educated filers from securing these victories. So the evidence suggests that Americans continue to stand up in large, significant numbers, and I believe in growing numbers.
Now, when you file, do you have to address some of these issues with them over and over? Do you always get notice of intent to levy or frivolous letters or proposed changes to your return?
Most educated filers get nothing but a check.
Hmm.
Pure and simple. There are very, very, very few, a tiny minority that get any kind of hassle. And those cases, though, are actually the most interesting of all. I have a number of them posted, about, I think, 45 or 46 individual cases in particular, in great depth, and then another 20 or 30 in somewhat lesser depth. They're fully documented cases in which the IRS or a state tax agency attempted to resist uneducated filers' claims. And in these cases, these resistance efforts are sometimes fairly protracted. They can go on for as long as a year and a half or 2 years. Usually it's a lot less time than that, but it can go that long. And they involve a great deal of very close agency supervision of the circumstance, a lot of phone calls, letters, sometimes personal visits, all of which take place with apparent complete seriousness and drama and stern and drang, and then in the end the check issues to the claimant. So they're the cases I like posting the best, because they're even now, 10 years into this long train of victories and the enormous body of evidence, both of authority and of concrete examples like the kind we're talking about, there are still people out there that kind of mindlessly try to suggest that these victories are somehow slips through the cracks of some sort.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And 10 years down the road, that's just, absurd. It's just absolutely absurd. But these particular incidents, these cases where there was this elaborate effort to resist, put the wrong to that very dramatically and unmistakably. I mean, it's just ridiculous to suggest. It's ridiculous to suggest 10 years down the road that even the routine variety that don't have any back and forth contact are still slips through the cracks in their tens of thousands. But it's impossible to say it about those in which they had elaborate direct supervision from live people who were struggling to keep from writing that check and then ultimately had to do it. There's simply no. There isn't any answer to that.
So how has the IRS been able to maintain such power spewing this misinformation, withholding the truth? Do people working in the IRS know these concepts?
I think most people in the IRS don't have any idea whatsoever. I like to think that more of them know more over the course of time, because they're citizens just like any others, and they have access to information. They are probably trained and conditioned to have a lot of reflexive blind spots and blinders that keep them from taking information that's sort of contrary to their mission statement in very readily. But they're people and citizens, and so I think that some of them are learning. But the IRS is an institution that has benefited from a huge focused constituency of interest. There is a massive industry, just a massive industry of service providers alone that relies on the mythology that the agency exploits. And then, of course, there are substantial political interests in the country that view their bread as being buttered or their interests being furthered by this massive tax structure. We didn't end up getting the misapplication of the tax by accident. We got it because there was a campaign on to encourage misunderstanding. The misunderstanding didn't actually take effect in any meaningful way until the mid-1940s, in the midst of World War II. Prior to that time, there had the largest percentage of American households that had ever filed a tax return prior to 1942 was 17%, and that was during the peak of World War I, when there were a lot more federally connected payments going out. Otherwise, the average from 1862 through 1942 ran about 8.9% of households that filed tax returns, because most Americans understood the limits of the tax. They knew what the tax was. It wasn't until the mid-1940s when that number, the 8.9% neighborhood, jumped within a course of 3 or 4 years to 93%, and it has stayed there ever since. It was a combination of a number of factors, too much to elaborate on right now, although I have them all posted, and if it's possible to give a URL for
sure, of course.
Go to losthorizons.com/documents with a capital D /the16th.htm. And at that page will be found an in-depth but very accessible study of the history of the tax and its transformation from the tax that it really is written as to the kind of behemoth, apparent capitation sort of thing that we have today, all of which took place during the course of about 10 years, middle of the last century, and has stuck with us ever since, up till 2003 when Cracking the Code was first published. And I hope people will go to that site and read that. Learning the truth about these things is so, it's earth-shaking to an individual, and it's really important to the future of this country. The founders relied on people knowing this information and acting on this kind of information. They relied, they wrote a constitution, but the constitution doesn't enforce itself. It requires individual Americans to act on its behalf, to look out for their own interests, both as to the preservation of the rule of law, and also look out for their own interests in a purely practical financial way. And in so doing, automatically act as a restraint on the state, which is what the founders had in mind. They created a limited government. They intended the government to be small, efficient, not lumbering around the world, working its will on behalf of corporate interests or political factions or what have you. It was friendship with all, entangling alliances with none, as Washington famously said in his farewell address. That was the idea. Small government. For the first 140 years or so of our history, the total impact that government at all levels had on citizens in this country was below 10% of GDP. That was state, federal, local, all combined, averaged below 10% of GDP. Right now, the feds alone are in the 40% neighborhood when you total it all up. It's a dramatic change and not a good change. We've gone from a situation where we were prosperous and free to a situation where we're neither, and going to get worse.
Well, now you also have the private sector businesses who are basically helping to facilitate elements of this scheme. They're profiting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I meant about a constituency of interest. The tax professions, the accounting professions, the human resource professions, everything from H&R Block to the human resources department at GM, it has a something of an interest, or at least imagines itself to have an interest in this subject. And then, in addition to that, again, it's the political interests that are the beneficiaries of the money that get the money. Congress takes in this huge volume of funds without any meaningful political check. Once the tax rate is established at the place that the particular rate that it's at, the money just comes in. They don't need to do anything. They don't need to vote on it. They don't need to take accountability for it. All they have to do is figure out what they're going to spend it on. And so there are these substantial interests, beneficiaries, that also are not exactly interested in rocking that boat or upsetting that status quo, because they are a part of the benefit gain. So it's a conspiracy of interest that is a soft conspiracy. It's not a deliberate conspiracy. It's not something where people in a smoke-filled back room plan this out and rub their hands and go out into the world the Illuminati or something. It's a lot of interests that coincide, that serve each other's purposes, and every one of them looking out for themselves the way the founders intended each of us to look out for themselves succeeds in helping maintain this huge fiction and this mythology that by which the rest of us basically are fleeced for a huge portion of our earnings.
There's another interesting element to this is the paper money we use. It's IOU, it's debt instruments. Is that even income?
It is, because despite the fact that an IOU is a debt instrument, as you say, you still can get your grocer to take it in exchange for groceries. So it would be impossible to argue that a gain was not being had by receiving it. But more than that, the actual definitions in the tax law say that it doesn't matter what you get paid in. It could be in Federal Reserve notes. It could be in livestock. It could be in shares of ownership. It could be in whatever, tobacco leaves. And it still qualifies as the thing subject to the tax. So No, the fact that one's being paid in a inflation prone fiat currency is not an escape from the application of the tax anyway.
So let's talk about this tax code, because most people, they just shut down just from the energy of it. They can't even go there and they live in fear of the IRS. What is it about this tax code that makes people so turned off?
Well, the IRS has cultivated a reputation of fearsomeness. It likes to have itself characterized as the scariest agency of the federal government. And I've actually seen plaques posted in IRS offices that say things kind of along that line. And it does that, I believe, for two reasons. One, there's just, this certain kind of adolescent locker room thing that, satisfies some juvenile egos. But more importantly, I think it's because the system actually benefits from people being afraid of it. When people are afraid of things, they don't look closely at them. And the tax code is an area that the IRS would love people to view as kind of a dark alley that you have to hurry past and not look closely into, because, for fear of what you might see, and you just don't want to be paying it that much attention because you don't want it to notice you either. And so people don't look, and that works just perfectly for the folks that want ignorance to rule the day.
Mm-hmm.
There is a quote that I came across. Actually, I had a reader send me this, and I really love it. This is from Jack Warren Wade Jr., who was an IRS officer in charge of the IRS's Nationwide Revenue Officer Training Program, who wrote a book after leaving the service called When You Owe the IRS. And here's what one of the things he has to say in it. He says, "The tax code represents the genius of legal fiction. The IRS has never really known why people pay the income tax. The IRS encourages voluntary compliance through fear." That's it. They do. They rely a lot on people being afraid and therefore not knowing. People are afraid and therefore they won't look. They don't examine. They don't want to look at it. This is not because it's complicated law. People have lawyers look at complicated law all the time. It's because this structure has encouraged this impression of scariness, and it's a terrible thing that an American citizen should find themselves in a state of anxiety over a body of their own law. I mean, our structure is what it is. This is our law. Everything that goes on in this country is ours, and yet that's just how it is.
The other disgusting thing here is, what is it, about 60% of taxes goes to fund the war? And then I'd say probably the other 40% goes to fund the building of our own prison right here in America.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. Well, I alluded to that earlier when I said that, Joe Smith agrees to the notion that his earnings are the taxable stuff. And even though it's going to get used to a great degree, what's going to get taken from him is going to get used against his interest. Not only is it against his interest to lose the money in the first place, but it's going to get spent on things that he would not approve of and that will, ultimately very possibly be a direct harm to him. It's a terrible thing. That money gets used to buy the bullets that make widows and orphans and lifelong enemies of all Americans, in other countries, in service to, who knows what interests, but certainly not that of most Americans. It is used to finance the DOJ attorneys that harass people for, failing to package their imported lobsters properly and send them off to prison for a few years. and all the huge host of nanny state abuses to which Americans are subject these days. It's a terrible scourge.
And now you have these companies that are all part of this snitch culture. You have now, what is it, PayPal, all these payment gateway systems. They all have to go report what you're making to the IRS now.
Well, they think they do. They think they do in the same way that that everyone thinks that they have to write those W-2s and those 1099s and so forth about payments that they make. And we had the credit card reporting, transaction reporting, added to the tax law structure last year.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you look at that, the language of that law, that section of law, you find that it's exactly the same as the other sections. It does not actually apply to any credit card transaction done by anybody, any place. It applies only to a very narrow subset of credit card transactions. You know, the government agencies use credit cards too, and the law is actually very clear. It's actually more clear in that new body of law than a lot of the older versions or older portions, where other kinds of reporting forms are spelled out and introduced. I have on my website an analysis of that credit card transaction reporting requirement. Anybody that is being subjected to that, I strongly encourage a look at that law. It'll be very uplifting and reassuring to you.
Yeah, thanks for that. Another question for you. What about property taxes when you get the bill for your car or your boat or your house? What do you do?
Not the same thing. Property taxes are under an entirely different structure.
Okay.
Property taxes are local. They're state-based taxes. States don't have the same constitutional restrictions that the federal system does, necessarily. Some states have varying types of restrictions, but none automatically has the same apportionment requirement for direct tax and what have you. And it's actually informative to think about what happens with a property tax bill. You don't get cajoled into creating some kind of a document declaring your property tax bill and asking you to sign at the bottom under penalty of perjury, making the declaration as to what it is you're talking about. It just doesn't work that way. You just get an invoice.
Yeah.
That's all that happens with a property tax bill. You get an invoice because that is a direct tax, and it's a tax that is not, there's no flim-flam going on in that tax. There's no effort to get you to agree that you're property is subject to the tax or anything like that. It's just very straightforward. If the income tax actually fell on what the IRS would like everyone to imagine that it does, that's how it would work too. So it's very instructive to recognize that it doesn't work that way, and there's a reason for that.
Now, what do you say to all the conspiracy folks who say, it's just better to not send in or sign any forms to the IRS because it's going to make me part of the system?
I say you're crazy. I say, what would you do if someone went down to the local police station and filed an affidavit declaring that you had were illegally parked last night? Would you just not do anything at all?
Nope.
And wait for the ticket to show up? No, you'd get noticed of that allegation, and you'd stomp down to the police station. You'd say, "Hell no, I was not illegally parked, and here's my affidavit, making clear that I was not." That's what you would do, and that's to stand silent in the case of an allegation being made against you. Now, if no allegations are being made, if nobody's creating W-2s or 1099s or other information returns reporting, alleging that you earned or received taxable earnings, then there isn't any reason to say anything.
That's right.
But very few people that are in that situation. Most people do get paid by someone who does create these things. That's the real tragedy of the situation.
The 1099s.
Yeah, the information returns that are being created by people who are completely ignorant about what they're saying, and they're only doing it because they think they have to. That's the real tragedy. If that were to stop, everything else would stop too.
Mm-hmm.
And no one would have to file anything. No one would,
Well, these companies would save money, too, because they have to have all these extra accountants just to prepare all this stuff.
They would save a huge amount of money, and it isn't just that. As I mentioned earlier, Social Security and Medicare, those are just income taxes, too. And yet these companies that create these W-2s and so forth, they're paying 7.65% of their payroll for these taxes. They're not obliged to pay those taxes either. Those are no more legitimate on non-federally connected earnings than any other. And so these companies have that much at least at stake, in addition to what you said about the compliance costs, which are indeed substantial. So I have the statistics. Someplace in Cracking the Code, I have the statistic as to the compliance costs at the time of writing, which, you know, 2003, and it was a huge amount. There were more hours spent on the accountancy associated with paying the income tax than were spent back then on all manufacturing activities in this country. we've lost some manufacturing capacity since then, so that number, the differential is probably, you know, considerably higher at this point, but that's still, you know, that's a very telling figure. There's a huge compliance cost associated with it.
Now, do the elite know of what we've been discussing here? Are they paying taxes? Is Mr. Rockefeller paying taxes?
I'm sure some of them know it. Well, Mr. Rockefeller, see, he's one of those guys that would be a privileged beneficiary, probably. He probably does make a notable amount of income, you know, quote-unquote income. And the fact is, this is one of the reasons, you know, I mentioned earlier that I view the tax as a beneficial affair. I'm happy with this tax. I wouldn't be without it. And the reason for that is because of its real nature. This is a tax that's intended to recover for the public purse some portion of the private benefits that are had by people using public property to make money. And that specifically falls on things like the national railroads, national banks, the Federal Reserve System, armaments manufacturers, the very well-paid federal workforce, investors in federal corporations, which tend to do very well. These are privileged activities, and it's privileged beneficiaries that are the ones that owe this tax, people like Rockefeller. And so, you know, we all should be completely enthused about this tax being applied the way it ought to be. The only thing to be not enthused about is when it is, you know, misapplied, and that's a consequence of an individual's own ignorance, to a fortunate degree. But no, that's one of the beauties of the thing. Rockefeller, he may very well know these truths, but he isn't able to benefit from them. Here's how he does benefit, though. By having helped promote the mythology, to whatever degree he may have, that the tax is far broader in its legitimate application than it really is. The pain of ginning up the, you know, $2.7 trillion that it produces these days is spread over virtually the entire population, the entire working population of the country. Whereas if people understood the realities of this tax and what it really applies to, that pain would be spread over only that little privileged beneficiary group. And that privileged beneficiary group would be paying a whole lot more than what they're paying right now.
Mm.
So Rockefeller does benefit from the mythology. He doesn't benefit from the truth about the tax. He benefits from people misunderstanding the tax, because he only pays his little bit, and the middle class pays, you know, this huge portion of it as well. Now, you know, the differential between what the extremely wealthy pay and what, you know, the average middle class person pays, in hard numbers, the wealthy pay a great deal more. But overall, the middle class is sparing the privileged class an awful lot of burden.
Well, they're trying to kill the middle class in this country.
There seems to be a serious a failure to recognize the importance of the middle class and to nurture it. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know that anyone is, you know, deliberately looking to kill that goose that lays the golden eggs, but because the middle class tends to be the productive class. But certainly there is precious little nurturing of what the middle class needs to survive and thrive, and so it is definitely dying off. Yes, we're seeing a split in what is an increasingly large underclass and an increasingly large and increasingly elite, kind of 1% class.
Well, it's like in a socialist society.
Yeah, very much. There's an oligarchic structure and there's the serfs.
Hey, you know, in Sweden, since you have a Swedish background, I thought this would be kind of fun. The cash registers of the businesses are wired straight to the tax office. Can you believe that?
No kidding.
So, yeah. Even the girl that was doing my hair once, she was afraid, you know, to open up the cash register to get some money out to get some coffee. Oh, no,
the tax office
is going to know I opened it and didn't put anything in. I took it out. You know?
Yeah, that's a country that unfortunately has a storied and noble history in many ways, and yet has kind of gone way down the road to a socialist disaster.
Oh, yeah. So what should people be prepared for when they choose to stand up in accordance with the truth here?
A lot more money in their pockets and a lot more dignity in their hearts. That's the one completely consistent consequence of learning this truth. It's very empowering, and that empowerment is not only of a legal character, but of a spiritual character. Prior to knowing how this all works, one is kind of just being pushed around by the system and being pushed around in a daze almost. And that doesn't mean that everybody is walking around blank faced wondering what's going on. But when you learn what you didn't know, you will realize that for all practical purposes, you were very much that way. Even though you were carrying on your life and maybe were the coolest thing on the block. But you now know you're empowered in the kind of the same way that the revolutionary generation was, of which it was remarked during that revolutionary period when England was Parliament was discussing what would be the next draconian assault on the colonists. And Edmund Burke got up and he said, "You guys, just hang it up." He said, "Don't bother. Those will never conquer those people. You will never subjugate those people into colonists again. They've been reading the law." And he was right. That's what it took. It takes people understanding the nature of law. When you learn this truth about the tax law, you discover that the federal structure is actually a whole different thing than what you imagined it was. There's a lot of scamming going on. There's a lot of exploitation of ignorance. But it is not nearly the rogue, out of control monstrosity that it appears to be. It's getting there, but it's getting there now for two reasons. One, because there were some pretexts that allowed for some political push behind some dramatic things like the Patriot Act and so forth. But it's also getting there because the longer that certain kinds of excesses are allowed to go on, the more they become routinized and institutionalized, and so we definitely have a fear right now, a legitimate fear that it's going to turn south in a big way. It's well on the road to that, and a lot of the tools of a truly dangerous turning south are being put into place and allowed to just accumulate. Because people are ignorant about the realities of the federal structure, but it's well within our reach to reverse this process if people will get educated about the real relationship between government and citizen and the real manner in which things go on. For instance, just to take an example that is another big player in the public policy scene, drug laws. Mm-hmm. Big factor in a lot of people's lives, not because people are drug users or drug dealers or drug enforcers, but we're all affected in some ways by that. Arguably, the assaults on the Fourth Amendment have been more at the hands of the drug warriors than they have at the hands of the NSA and the surveillance state. They're kind of Johnny-come-latelys on that front, and even all of Edward Snowden's recent revelations, some of them suddenly took sort of a back step when it was revealed that the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, had been doing these same things for many, many years,
and they're
sharing data, and so forth. And yet the drug laws are all based on the Commerce Clause. There is no actual federal constitutional structure that allows the feds to dictate what people put in their bodies or what kind of things they buy and sell, any more than there is for alcohol. There had to be a constitutional amendment for alcohol prohibition to go into effect. There would need to be one for drug prohibition to go into effect, the drug prohibition of the sort that people imagine that there is right now. But what there actually is it all goes back to the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1908, I think it was, or 07, when drug labeling was being taken control of to a certain degree by the feds, and only for drugs that cross state lines. And from that, the entire drug interdiction and prohibition structure in this country rests on that act and its Commerce Clause citation of interstate commerce and the Pure Food and Drug Act and the labeling component. It isn't at all what people imagine it to be. And if you understand the way federal law actually works, you learn how to study, how to look into these things, do research on these subjects, and you discover that all the federal law that we find so problematic today actually has some kind of benign origin that has been allowed to become contorted and distorted into something threatening to us by virtue of ambition on the part of the executive branch people responsible for it, ignorance on the part of the American public, sensationalizing on the part of the media, and a few other factors. But when you get down to the heart of all of it, it's actually a very manageable thing. It just requires, exposing what it really rests on. Mm. And it's kind of like, Alice and the cards, in Alice in Wonderland. At the end of it, you're all pack of cards, she said, and she then grew into the big human that was capable of disregarding these little, annoyances that the people who had been threatening her suddenly were revealed to be. So it falls to all of us to learn these things and become, responsible grown-up Americans again, looking out for our interests from a standpoint of knowledge.
That's right. It seems like the relationship between government and citizen today is much different than perhaps what our founding fathers envisioned. Maybe they weren't such bad guys after all, huh?
Yeah, not at all.
Well, whoever was responsible for writing the tax code was brilliantly cunning, deceitful, and deliberately confusing, but you, Peter, are even more brilliant and victorious for cracking this code and deconstructing the lies. So I thank you for all your hard work and your courage to come out and speak out. We need more men like you.
Well, thank you very much, and it's been a great pleasure speaking with you, Lana.
I encourage all of you listening to visit Peter's website, losthorizons.com, and please purchase his book, Cracking the Code. There's also a CD that explains the form process. And this is not a bunch of BS or a sales gimmick. His research gets results, and results are what we need right now more than anything. Do yourself justice. Stop paying the crooks, thieves, and murderers who are building your prison, those who lie and use force and coercion. Choose to govern yourself and govern your own resources. This matrix stays intact through widespread ignorance and fear. One more thing. Some fear that if enough people began filing educated returns, the powers that be would simply change constitutional law since they already disregard it and do what they want anyway. But the key thing here is us, the people. We're the ones that allow or don't allow these crooks to operate outside the original true framework put in place when this country was founded. The original jurisprudence, the U.S. Constitution, which is much better than what we have today. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance because the jaws of power are always open to devour, whether done by law or outside of it. Take care.